This Second Childhood production is for the Killer Bees podcast and I mix what I like.org. Joining us again is Dr. Todd Stephen Burroughs, comes back in this instance to talk with us about Henry Louis Gates' most recent documentary, Africans in America, Many Rivers to Cross. The African Americans, Many Rivers to Cross, which is aired. It just wrapped up, last week on PBS. And admittedly, I've only seen the final episode, the 1968 to 2013 piece, and I have a number of issues with that. But tell us what you've said, what you've had to say about the documentary overall. What did you think it did or does?
Well, you know, it's a personal essay by Henry Louis Gates. It's his personal interpretations of the history of African Americans from the beginnings of the slave trade, including, you know, where we were taken from Africa, all the way up to the present. And so it is very much a personal recollection, a personal interpretation. He himself has said that he asked a group of scholars for the 15 or 20 essential African-American stories or anecdotes that he could weave in and out throughout history. And so he made a list of like these essential little pictures, little stories of Africans and African-Americans that could illustrate the larger period of time that he discusses. And so he does a documentary that blends those stories in with historians who discuss whatever era he's talking about. Now, being that he did a six-part series, every part was basically designed to be an hour version of a 40 to 60-year period in African-American life. So he's painting with a very broad brush. And as we know as historians and scholars, that can be very dangerous because there are things you have to leave out and marginalize. And then when you counter in Gates' own biases, he's a literary scholar, not a historian, although his position as a quote-unquote intellectual entrepreneur has now trumped that. He is a former journalist who worked at Time Magazine. So, you know, he has the skills and worked at The New Yorker, of course, writing articles for The New Yorker. So he has the skills to do everything that he's doing. But, of course, with his own biases, particularly his bias against black nationalism, pan-Africanism, or anything more radical than the Democratic Party, with all of those biases mixed in, you have, of course, at best, to be most polite, a very mixed product, and that's what we have with the African-American.
So let's talk about some of those biases. I mean, we've known of Gates over the years as publicly attacking Afrocentricity in all of its iterations, attacking Dr. John Henry Clark, as you said, claiming himself as an intellectual entrepreneur, which I think easily translates into selling your intellectual hustle to the highest bidder. Yale trained, Harvard located, W.E.B. Du Bois Institute, chair or head of, what are these biases and how do they play out in this documentary? I mean, I saw them. I mean, the last piece is a trip. His last segment and the way he discusses 1968 to today. But up until that point, and then we can, you know, sort of I'll jump in on that one. Up until that point, how do those biases play out throughout the documentary?
Well, the first part deals with us being brought from Africa and the beginnings of the slave trade, in which, of course, he spends 10 minutes of the hour talking about how Africans enslaved other Africans. As if the Africans knew that they were enslaving people for the most, you know, barbaric version of slavery ever recorded in, you know, the last 500 years, which, by the way, is a point that's not made, right? So he tries to show the quote-unquote complexity of the slave trade and, you know, by spending time doing that. So you begin to feel from the beginning that, okay, You know, this is not Abilene, Missouri, right? This is not somebody who's going to attack the West. He's going to talk and
well, even Ali Mazraoui, I mean, isn't the most radical we could even get. Only, you know, when juxtaposed to Gates, I mean, the whole triple heritage piece that he, you know, equates Islam in the West as part of a anyway. Well, I don't want to get into all of that, but anyway, your point is still well taken.
Talk about that as well, because yes. Missouri is all pro-Islam, but he's at least anti-Western.
Right, right.
Well, Gates, of course, is not anti-Western, being from Piedmont, West Virginia. So remember, you know, Gates' perspective is from Piedmont, West Virginia. So how would somebody from Piedmont, West Virginia, who hates Black nationalism, hates Pan-Africanism, how would he describe the slave trade? How would he describe... various points in American history.
Well, let's take another one very quickly, because you mentioned also that how this plays out in his coverage of major figures as in our history. So how does Du Bois, for instance, you were telling me something very interesting about how you saw Du Bois show up in this documentary.
Well, Du Bois shows up the way a literary scholar would have Du Bois show up. There's no way a literary scholar would do a segment on the Harlem Renaissance, which I think was episode 3 or 4, and not, of course, talk about Du Bois and the crisis and you know, the major figures of the Harlem Renaissance. So Du Bois begins and ends with the crisis and the NAACP and the Harlem Renaissance. Now, the more radical Du Bois that became a communist, that moved to Ghana, all of that, not in the Henry Louis Gates essay. It was not relevant to him because, again, this is a personal essay. I want to emphasize this. You know, this is kind of like a more subjective version of, I think, what was the book, Vincent Harding's There is a River, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of like a documentary version of There is a River, because he's connecting all of these phases of African-American history. And as a literary person, as a magazine writer, he knows how to make these connections and make them very smoothly. But of course, to make these connections, your biases have to shine through. So the more radical Du Bois, for instance, is not discussed. When we get to episode 5, Paul Robeson is mentioned. I think this is the 1940 to 1968. And Paul Robeson is mentioned. He's mentioned as a magnificent person who was a kind of tragic figure because he embraced communism and he was out of the mainstream, Gates argues, of the movement. So although he gives Robeson credit for setting up the intellectual foundation for the direct action movement, he does not give Robeson credit for being part of a long Black radical tradition. Because why? Because Hubert Harrison and the Black communists and all the people that Robin D.G. Kelley writes about are irrelevant to Henry Louis Gates.
But Robin D.G. Kelley is interviewed for the documentary, which I thought was interesting, the way that Gates sprinkles in these somewhat left-leaning variants of left-leaning Black radical tradition participants throughout as interviewees. But then greatly limits their conversation, whether it's Kathleen Cleaver or even Karenga or Robin D.G. Kelley. There's a very limiting conversation I saw, particularly, well, obviously in the one episode that I did see, the final one. They're very much limited to avoid those kinds of conversations, because I was thinking, where is the Robin Kelley of Freedom Dreams, where he covers all of the variants or many of the variants of this radical tradition, none of which is he asked about or none of which is included in his commentary for this documentary. How does Garvey show? Was Hubert Henry Harrison even mentioned? And how does Garvey show up?
Of course not. No Black radicals of Harrison's type was mentioned. Garvey was mentioned during the Harlem Renaissance episode, of course, as a tragic figure. And Robeson was kind of picked to represent all of the Black communists and all of those people who did all of that work. You know, I mean, I don't have to mention names like Esther Jackson and all of that. So Robeson represents all of those people, but again, he is dismissed. He is brought up, He is thanked for his contributions in setting the intellectual foundation for the modern civil rights movement. Then he is dismissed because he is not part of the modern day integrationist liberal civil rights movement that Gates is saying is the dominant stream of African American thought. Even forgetting the fact that there are radical elements within that. But it sounds like, Dr. Ball, you really want to talk about episode 6. So let's talk about
episode 6. Well, I mean, it's the only one that I saw, and I was just looking at the way that he constructed, again, those variants of the left. And, from our earlier conversation, it sounds like this was something that was prevalent throughout the entire discussion. So, I mean, he didn't even mention, correct me if I'm wrong, but he didn't even mention Angela Davis's name, which I thought would have been an easy one to include, given her symbolic relationship to this movement, even more, you know, never mind what the radical community still, you know, offers as a critique of her since then. But I didn't even see her in this. So, I mean, we didn't.
No, she was not mentioned. But keep in mind, let's remember, this is still PBS, right? So let's remember that even in Eisner Prize, even in the second Eisner Prize series that PBS doesn't like to air, right? Even in Eisner Prize, George Jackson is only mentioned as some guy who wrote a book who died, who inspired the people from Attica. Like,
well, I never expected to see George in this, but that's what I'm saying. I mean, I figured, right. But Angela Davis, in particularly in her you know, her modern form is very right. Welcomed into polite circles. I mean, Well, I mean, I thought that she might have at least got a mention. But what I was fascinated is, as you had warned me, of the way that Kathleen Cleaver and I put out a request for an interview with her, because I really want to ask her what was that conversation like as it happened in real time. Because it was striking, even. Granted, with your warning of it, it was still to me striking how her response to his question about offered in a dismissive way. He asked, you know, what world did the Panthers really expected to see? What did they really want to do? What world did they expect to see? And she says, well, it was to be a brilliant one or something to that effect. And then she's just cut off. I mean, sharp cut. Away from whatever their worldview, you know, would have had as a construction for the modern world. All that's cut off, and then he returns to allow Karenga the final thoughts on the Black Panther Party. And obviously, given his bias against the party, I thought that was odd. And especially given it was like the two conservative wings of the Black political spectrum united. The conservative cultural nationalist form of Karenga, certainly the conservative integrationist assimilationist form of Gates, conspired in that moment to speak negatively and dismissively against the entire Black Panther Party and its importance to this history, even dismissing Hoover's own claim that the Panthers were the most dangerous threat to national security of the United States. Gates and Karenga dismissed this as a possibility. And then Karenga says, well, they were afraid of our unity, whatever that unity is meant to mean in that moment. So, I mean, it was predictable and consistent. Obviously still something, you know, bothersome to say the least.
I'm not going to repeat the point you made, but instead I'm going to do a John Rennie Clark and talk around the question to get to the question, right? When you look at the Black Power mixtape and you look at the Swedish reporter who asked Angela Davis, why is she a communist? Why does she believe in socialism? She gives a fascinating answer, particularly in the context of our modern life right now, dealing with trying to get, you know, some sort of semblance of like socialized healthcare. She makes the point that any country that is as advanced as the United States is, if a country that advanced could be pushed towards socialism, if a country that advanced that could literally provide every resource for every person, and that's how she describes the United States, if that country could be pushed in a socialist direction, we would almost have utopia. To me, that sounds like the answer that probably Kathleen Cleaver gave that was cut. There was a very clear analysis that people had of why they went left. They went left because they said the United States is well equipped, since it's stolen all everybody else's land and stolen all sorts of things. It's well equipped to provide everything for their citizens. But that kind of perspective can no longer be articulated.
Well, I mean, I even like the perspective of Safia Bukhari, who said that right. It wasn't radicalism that brought her into the Panther Party. It was the New York City Police Department.
Which is the same thing that Mia said.
Which is right. And given,
by the way, to talk about Gates, right? You know, Gates makes it seem in that last episode that being radical was something foreign, right? But again, I mean, this is why we need, you know, other shows and other things, like, because I just found the episode of Like It Is on YouTube with Asada Shakur when Gil Noble went to interview Asada Shakur. And the way she explains how she got into the movement, it was a logical decision to be radical. And Gil Noble backed her up with all of this file footage from the movement and what people were going on in the movement. So going to the more radical part, you know, it's kind of like Asada Shakur was saying, like, how could you not do that? But see, in the Gates analysis, that's the wrong move, because you and I know, Jared, that in that sixth episode, he goes from the Black Panther Party, and again, the exact question he asks Karenga is, who was afraid of the Black Panthers? They're only this small group. I mean, that's right. Against Black Panther history, I know. But he goes from the Black Panther Party to he and Kirk Smoke at Yale.
That's right.
And saying, you know, we were trying to integrate the power elite.
Well, he said, I mean.
Our version of Black Power was to integrate the power elite.
Absolutely.
And I'm going, you're going from the Black Panthers to Yale?
And to his credit, they honestly made the accurate and honest point that he and his compatriots at Yale were the true beneficiaries of that movement, that they benefited from that movement, even as he dismisses it and derides it and looks to distance himself from it. That point did slip in there by hook or by crook. And I thought that was an interesting moment as well, but they did do that. And then, of course, as you've been saying, in our discussions around our criticism of Manning Marable's book on Malcolm X, that the documentary has to sort of predictably end with this description of Barack Obama as the successful culmination of this movement, because he does say again, from the plantation to the White House, as if this has been a completed and successful movement, even with the sort of obligatory tributes to the fallen Oscar Grant and Trayvon Martin and those who are suffering mass incarceration. And by the way, even just very quickly, with Michelle Alexander brought back into this documentary to be the spokesperson on this issue of mass incarceration, the documentary
She's the radical, but I
did notice that. But even as the radical, the documentary does just what her book does and ignores all of the decades preceding this moment that of radical resistance to the extension of slavery in the prison system. So they ignore
that's irrelevant to Piedmont, West Virginia, and Yale because it's a personal essay.
That ends with him walking by Kane off into the sunset.
Now, the interesting thing about Obama that we cannot leave this discussion without saying on air is that his discussion of the Obama administration and race I thought was very interesting and very personal, because he talked about how President Obama rarely talked about race, and one of the few times he talked about race was in his second term. And then, you know, they cut to the Trayvon Martin, you know, if I was, you know, Trayvon could have been me, you know. And I'm sitting there thinking, like, wait a minute. But I remember President Obama very early on in his presidency discussing race quite pointedly. And it was quite controversial. Now, you know, maybe I'm wrong, Dr. Ball, but I remember that incident being about Henry Louis Gates.
That's right.
Getting arrested in front of his house for breaking into his house. Somehow that racial discussion, which, as you remember, Dr. Ball, took up at least a month of major news coverage, somehow that got skipped.
And the beer summit that ensued was also left out. All of that was left out. I'm sure he would say that was his way of keeping his own personal distance from his work, even as even as his work is as you said, his travel log, his literally his walk through African history in the United
That's
States.
Right.
Well, Dr. Todd Stephen Burrows, thank you very much for joining us again. Your work can be found at drumsintheglobalvillage.com. And we will, of course, have you back on in the not too distant future. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you so much.
This Second Childhood production is for the Killer Bees podcast and I Mix What I Like.org.
Yeah. Yeah, let's live it.